Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Demonstrations continued across New England last night, protesting police brutality and the death of George Floyd, from Worcester to Northampton to Providence. There are more planned, including one in Boston's Franklin Park tonight, a rally and vigil for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. Joining me now is one of the organizers, Monica Cannon Grange. She's the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston, focused on advocating for marginalized communities. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hello.
Hi, Monica. And listeners, we want to hear from you all hour. What's your reaction to the protests and demonstrations? Have you been a part of a demonstration here in the area? How are you feeling today, and what do you think needs to change here in Boston and in the Commonwealth? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Monica Cannon Grant, this vigil was organized by Violence in Boston and Black Lives Matter Boston. What's the message you want to communicate with the event tonight?
So the message that we're trying to convey is Not One More, which is the name of our event, which means you don't get to keep killing us without us being silent, without us voicing our disgust, dismay, anger, frustration, and pain around it happening. But the other piece is we're also fighting for action and legislation to be passed to make police officers able to be criminally prosecuted for killing us.
This isn't the first event that you've organized in Boston. A 2017 March Against White Supremacy drew in over 45,000 people. You had a hand in a counter protest to the Straight Pride Parade last year, the 2019 Women's March. The stakes for protesting right now are higher than ever with the coronavirus spreading in our communities, national tensions so high. Does it feel different now, and is that on your mind?
So, yes, I'm definitely worried about the coronavirus. I think that, you know, I get those who have compromised immune systems not being able to come outside. But to wake up a Black woman raising four Black boys, I don't have that luxury. And every day, Black people are faced with COVID, with community violence, and then on top of it, being killed by those who have been charged with protecting and serving us. So every day I wake up, I'm an activist. It's just a matter of which thing am I going to activate on at that particular time. But with that in mind, we are ensuring that everybody who comes out today has adequate PPE. So we have volunteer EMTs and nurses who will be providing masks and gloves and hand sanitizers. We have medics who have volunteered their time. We have water that we'll be providing with everybody. We're creating chalk circles on the grass for social distancing once we get to the rally point, just to give people space to not be as close to each other. But the truth is this has to happen. Protesting is the voice of the unheard. And what we feel right now is nobody's listening. It wasn't until we started protesting that this officer was arrested.
How many people do you expect tonight, Monica?
I have 7,000 people confirmed on the Facebook invite. And just to give you context, last time I did this in 2017, I had 10,000 people confirmed on the Facebook invite, but 45,000 showed up. So I'm definitely expecting thousands of people, but how many, I don't know.
So we're still learning about exactly what happened on Sunday night. There were peaceful protests all day, throughout the day. Mm-hmm. At some point Sunday night, there were confrontations with police and looting. Are you concerned about what could happen tonight, and are you anticipating that tonight will remain peaceful?
I'm anticipating that tonight will remain peaceful. I have no concerns. Everyone who helped organize this and helped put this together and that is supporting this are from our community. They have stake in this community. They raise their children here in this community. And so our number one job is to protect our community.
You just talked about potentially a huge number of people tonight. Have you been in communication with the Boston police or with other members of the city about the demonstration tonight?
Yes, I have had conversations with the mayor, Chief Gross, and Attorney General Maura Haley.
And what would you say is the tenor of their response to you and your planning?
So most of them know that I don't never ask for permission. I ask for forgiveness. The police have a job that they feel like they have to do, so they're going to do that. My contention is just basically this is what I'm doing and this is how I'm doing it. I'm never in a situation of asking for permission. From the elected official standpoint, they understand it needs to be done and they support it. They just, you know, their concern is safety and making sure that everybody is able to get home safely.
And do you feel supported by your broader community in organizing this demonstration tonight?
Oh, absolutely. I've literally pulled in community members to be in positions of security and marshals and all the things. So absolutely.
And Monica, what's your message to people, the thousands who are planning to join you tonight and the ones you may not know about who may decide to come last minute?
My message is don't let this be the only time you show up for Black Lives. Find a Black-owned business, a Black nonprofit to support and shift your funding to, because the bigger issue is that we have an equity issue. We have a housing issue. We have a workforce issue when it comes to lack of equity with black people. So don't let this be the only time. We'll be discussing ways that they can plug in into the community to assist with resources. And then we'll be discussing legislation that we're advocating for on a federal level to make it criminal to be killed by the police.
That's Monica Cannon Grant. She's an organizer for a protest plan tonight in Boston's Franklin Park, also the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston, which is focused on advocating for marginalized communities. Good luck tonight, and thank you for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Earlier today, elected officials of color from around Massachusetts spoke at the State House, calling for police reforms in the wake of George Floyd's death and demonstrations across the state. Here's how Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley framed these protests.
What you see happening throughout this nation is unrest, and it will persist for as long as there is unrest.
Congresswoman Pressley says she will file a resolution in the House of Representatives condemning police brutality and excessive use of force, the first such resolution since 1999. That one never made it to the floor. Officials today also proposed reforms at the state and local levels. Joining us now is Boston City Council President Kim Janey, who spoke at the event today. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hello, it's great to be here.
So, Councillor Janey, why was it important that elected officials of color come out together today and announce these policy proposals?
Well, as president of the most diversity council in Boston's history, it was really important that we, as councillors, joined with our colleagues across the Commonwealth to make this stand. You know, we literally are fighting for our lives here. We are fighting for our lives. You've heard it said over and over again, how exhausting this is, how traumatic it is. But we are literally fighting for our lives. And I find it's very interesting when the media or others who are kind of spectators in this kind of question, you know, the tactics that people use when they are fighting for their lives. I know COVID is a concern. And the irony here is that these events, the fact that we have to even protest around these issues, puts us at greater risk for COVID, something that we are more vulnerable to because of the inequities in this city, in this Commonwealth, and in our country. And because of those inequities that are systemic and grounded, rooted in this country's history of elevating a few at the expense of others, that is why we are in the situation. And so, you know, I find it a sad irony that we have to then re-expose ourselves to something to fight, you know, for our lives here.
You know, we heard just
COVID
now,
the... and this is compounding. So, you know, prior to these protests, we were already traumatized dealing with COVID. And now here we are yet again. And this time, there has to be some change. This has been going on nonstop. People keep saying, oh, well, this is different. For us, those of us who have been experiencing this, This is a nonstop broken record of injustice and brutality against Black people in this country, our country.
Counselor, I'd like to stop you there and ask you to talk a little bit more about the reforms that are being proposed at all levels of government. We heard a little bit about Congresswoman Presley's resolution. What are you proposing at the municipal level? And talk a little bit about the plans to bring those proposals forward.
Absolutely. And that is what has to happen from all of this. The protests are great. I'm a community organizer. I support, you know, peaceful protests, but it has to be coupled with legislative action. And so we stood this morning with legislative action at all levels, at the federal level, at the state level, and at the municipal level. And I'm really proud that in the city council tomorrow, we have a resolution affirming the resolution at the congressional level. And then there are a number of other ordinances that we have before us, whether facial surveillance and oversight. There are lots of bills that we have before us. The thing that I want to make clear is, yes, police brutality is an issue and reforming our criminal justice system is very important, but we've got inequities in all of these systems. So we also have to make sure that we're dealing with our housing crisis, that we're dealing in addressing the education of Black and brown children in our city. So there are lots of ways that we have to show up differently. And I'd like to also make this point that this work to dismantle this system, this oppressive system, it's going to take all of us, everyone. There cannot be any sitting on the sidelines on social media with the right hashtag. We need people on the front lines of this fight. We need people.
So let's talk about people coming out, Counselor. Mayor Walsh came out in support of the peaceful demonstrators on Sunday. The press conference on Monday really was full of people supporting, officials supporting the peaceful demonstrations on Sunday. We know Mayor Walsh also thanked police and safety officers for their professionalism Sunday. As you exhort people to come out, take action, I do want to ask you if you think the police response in Boston on Sunday night was appropriate and proportionate.
I want to say that I'm really proud, one, of the very peaceful protests that happened in my district. I know those protesters marched downtown and met up with others, and that protest, too, was very peaceful. What took place after the protest is what was problematic, and it's very unfortunate that we would have a few folks who would co-opt and take advantage of this opportunity for their own gain or their own agenda. I want to be clear, though. I'm glad that the mayor has come out. We need everyone to come out. But I want to make this point. It is not enough to just come out. What we are pushing for is legislative change. And what we also need for that to happen, we need for folks who do not look like us to take a hard look inward, and really reflect on your own privilege, position, and power in this country and how that plays out. And I think the more that we can all just take a step back and reflect and then really try to tackle the inequities, the better off we'll all be. I think we don't need to get into a place where people continue to deny that the problem exists. The hope
Counselor,
is that
what's a specific next step? What's a specific next step that you would like listeners who are hearing you talk to me right now on air? What's a specific next step you'd like to see them take?
Thank you. I think it is important, no matter who you are, if you are listening, to please take a moment to reflect. What is my role this moment in time, this important moment in our nation's history? Where will you stand? Will you stand on the side of justice? Will you ensure that the American ideals that we hold up and value in this nation will be realized for all of us? And for that to happen, it will take work. It will take hard work. It will take work that is uncomfortable. And it will take political will. That is our ask. We're also asking for people to get behind the legislation that was mentioned by Congresswoman Presley, as well as at the state level here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and at the city level. If there are bills that you are excited about and want to get behind, it is important that we get all of our other colleagues behind them as well. So that is a concrete step that listeners can take.
And what is your message to people who will come out and protest tonight? And do you intend to join them?
My hope is to connect with Monica. I was able to connect with her a little bit, I believe it was Sunday evening. And, you know, she's lives in my district. She's a great leader. You know, I think protest is important. I understand why people are protesting. I am protesting as well. I want people to be safe. In terms of, you know, their physical distance, that is important. People should show up with masks. And I, you know, heard the tail end of Monica's conversation, and I couldn't agree more. The folks in this community are working hard to build up their community. They're working hard to build it up. And that is the thing that we have to continue to do, all of us, from community members, residents, leaders, elected officials, all of us working together.
That's Boston City Council President Kim Janey. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
In moments of crisis, our nation often looks to the president for comfort and leadership. Yesterday, President Trump spoke with the nation's governors, stressing that they should be tougher when cracking down on demonstrations. In a rare moment, Massachusetts Republican Governor Charlie Baker responded.
At so many times during these past several weeks, when the country needed compassion and leadership the most, it was simply nowhere to be found. Instead, we got bitterness, combativeness, and self-interest. That's not what we need in Boston. It's not what we need right now in Massachusetts. And it's definitely not what we need across this great country of ours either.
Now, later that evening, while speaking to reporters in the Rose Garden, President Trump escalated his rhetoric, threatening military intervention.
If a city or a state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
Joining me now to help make sense of that and other events in Washington, D.C. yesterday is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, hi. An interesting day, Kimberly. President Trump started yesterday with this call, speaking to governors about dealing with the protests. Can you kind of give us a sense of that call and even your reaction to it?
Yes. So the call, according to some audio that was obtained by news organizations, it was a president who was angry. He was angry at what he saw as the failure of governors to control protests, to control unrest in their community. And he told the governors that it made them look weak, that they needed to do more, that they were a laughingstock of the world, used the word laughingstock, and that if they didn't do more to stop it, then he would. And hours later, he came out with this address. All day long, there was this push and pull to this question, was he going to speak to the nation? And the reporting was that he was not, because he had no new policy, no new solution to offer. He had tried to push it off onto the governors. And then there was this abrupt change where he was going to address the nation. There had been some peaceful protests assembled just on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue. For anyone who has visited the White House, that front facing, there were people gathered there. And suddenly, before the president started, a militarized effort to clear the peaceful protesters there, involving gas and flashbangs and mounted police, came through just minutes before the president gave this address, where he promised to send, quote, thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers and military personnel, end quote, into states. It was quite a shocking and unexpected turn of events yesterday.
And to clarify for our listeners, NPR is reporting that that force was made up of National Guard members and Parks Department police officers. Kimberly, Governor Baker's reaction yesterday to the president's comments was before things accelerated last night, but still really surprising, really unusual. And yet he noted he was not on the call. Were there any Republican governors who have responded to the president's exhortation or criticism yesterday?
Not openly. There obviously were a lot of Democrats who found the suggestion that the governors weren't doing enough really unhelpful and wrong. And again, Governor Baker was not on the call, but he's the one Republican who spoke very vocally, publicly against what the president had said. And we know Governor Baker is someone who's usually quite circumspect when it comes to his comments against Donald Trump. He'd more talk about what he wants to do as opposed to what Donald Trump is doing, even if he disagrees. This was a departure for him to speak so forcefully and frankly emotionally at that moment in opposition of him. There were with respect to the show of military force in front of the White House itself, the show of federal police force outside of the White House itself, he did draw some Republican opposition. For example, Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska said that he was, quote, against clearing out a peaceful protest for a photo op that treats the word of God as a political prop, referring to the fact that the president, after his address, once that front Lafayette Park was cleared, walked across the street to St. John's Episcopal Church and stood there and held up a Bible with other members of the White House staff and then simply walked back. And it was called a
Kimberly,
go ahead.
Well, no, sorry, I thought you were done with that sentence. I just want to invite listeners into this. What are your reactions to the president's choices over the last 24 hours, to Governor Baker's response, to other U.S. response? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kimberly, lots of criticism of the president for what's been framed, at least in some reports, as a photo opportunity in front of St. John's Church. What was the significance of that church? Why take a photograph there?
Well, all around the White House, as the protests, peaceful protests over the course of the last couple days turned more unruly at night, you had people committing acts of vandalism, including against this church. This church is historic, and it's a block away from the White House, and it was spray painted with graffiti. So in that sense, it was a way to stand in front of it and as a demonstration. It was also seen as a signal, a political signal, by the president to his evangelical supporters and others. Although the pastors, the people who were inside the church and had to flee, the bishop of the church condemned the president's move and said that the church should not be used as a political prop.
So let's talk about the president's remarks about the military. During his remarks, he essentially threatened to use the Insurrection Act of 1807 to deploy active U.S. troops to U.S. cities to provide a stronger response to these demonstrations. There's a lot there. What is the Insurrection Act? Can he actually deploy U.S. military to U.S. cities? Let's just start sort of at that intersection.
Yeah, so generally speaking, U.S. military is not allowed to act in a law enforcement capacity on U.S. soil. There are some exceptions, including evoking the Insurrection Act of 1807. That was most notably used in the 1950s in desegregation efforts, and it's been used a couple times since to quell uprisings and riots. Most recently in 1992, after the acquittal of the officers who beat Rodney King in Los Angeles when there were riots broke out in Los Angeles and across the country. That was the last time it was used, 1992. Interestingly enough, the attorney general at that time was Bill Barr, the current attorney general. But what it usually requires is a state to ask for this help. If the state cannot, if it doesn't have the resources to combat some, you know, massive upheaval, it can request of the federal government to do this. So the issue is, can the president push this and force this on his own? The law seems to indicate that if he feels that the situation prevents U.S. laws from being carried out or that it violates the rights of citizens, that the president can. But we don't know exactly where that line is, and we'll have to see if that line gets drawn in the sand and whether that will result in a legal challenge if the president does
take
that action.
Let's grab a call. Let's grab a call here, 800-423-8255. We've got Alfred on the line from Westford. Alfred, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say this is how fascism starts. We have seen this before. I don't think people have been talking enough about Trump's intention to declare Antifa a terrorist group. Antifa is short for anti-fascist. There are groups that call themselves Antifa, but there are also just groups of anti-fascist people that don't use the label, but sort of overlap with them. So what we're going to see, we've seen this before in Nazi Germany, they'll be declared a terrorist group. And this Tom Cotton, I believe, is already – Tom Cotton and Matt Gaetz, both in the Senate, have been trying to basically tar the entire protest movement as anti-fascist,
so,
left-wing radicals.
There.
Yes.
Let me stop you there because I don't want to take on too many points because I want us to be able to respond as we go along. Thank you for that call. There has been discussion of declaring Antifa a terrorist organization. Kimberly, what is the discussion in D.C. around that? And what is the discussion in D.C. about who is responsible for the violent or looting portions of protests that are happening around the country? We hear a lot of different reporting on that.
Well, in terms of declaring Antifa a terrorist group, that discussion seems to be centered entirely around the president's Twitter account. Federal law prohibits any sort of domestic group from being labeled a terrorist organization. We've heard that as the reason why, for example, the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups have not been designated as such. So that's the president tweeting that. There's really not that much more to it. But people in D.C. and throughout the country have said that there have been, in the midst of these protests, factions of folks who were not connected to the organized protest who have used this as an opportunity to try to start fights, pass out bricks, and encourage people to be violent. So that is a real problem that both law enforcement and community members have identified. But again, yes, it is not clear that this is some large unified effort by one group, or rather a lot of different groups taking advantage of a situation.
Let's grab one more call, Kimberly. We've got Derek on the line from Billerica. Derek, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was just, wanted to kind of bring up a point similar but different to the last caller that, you know, we have these, like, it's kind of devolving, you know, the protests are very peaceful during the day, and it seems like they're getting their point across well. I support that. But then at night, it's being hijacked or co-opted by these aggressive people who are, you know, making it really difficult for law enforcement and even, like, severely injuring law enforcement in a lot of cases. And it just seems like that's not getting enough attention, as opposed to the, you know, we need to, like, lift up the voice of the protesters, but we also need to, you know, respect our law enforcement. You know, not every one of them have committed these racist acts, and we need their support to improve our communities.
Thank you for that call, Derek. I appreciate it. And I do want to note for our listeners, we have invited Police Commissioner Gross to come on the show the last couple of days. He has been unavailable to do so, but we will continue to invite him to come on air. Kimberly, you may or may not have heard at the top of the hour when we were hearing about Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley's federal legislation, a lot of movement around legislation regarding police and police behavior, but also strong voices in Congress supporting the police in the position that they're in right now. Where is that coming out, or is that likely to come out in Congress? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, even if it does pass Congress, it's a resolution. It doesn't force the police to do something. It expresses the intent, as the congresswoman said. She said that the expression of the intent of Congress is powerful. It would be a move to press and pressure police into changing their own policies from the ground up, which is the only way that you can really do it from that sense. So we have seen an increase right now in energy behind that, where in the past we have not seen. But, you know, fixing racial inequality in the criminal justice system has never been an easy task. It's something that members of Congress have struggled with for decades, and this will be no different.
And that is WBUR's Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, I know it's a busy time. I appreciate you taking some of it to join us today.
My pleasure, as always.
We have been taking stock today of the moment we're in, the overall national response to George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police, the immediate events of the last few days in Boston and Washington. In our first two segments today, we learned about a call from elected officials of color to reform the police, plans for another peaceful protest tonight in Boston, and the actions of President Trump over the last 24 hours. And we've been taking your calls throughout. So for the rest of the hour, we want to process together. How are you thinking about this? How do you explain what's happening to yourself, to others? Where have we individually and collectively failed, and what are we doing right? What has to happen next? Share your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. For this conversation, we have two guests. We're joined by Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, also an activist and an organizer. Welcome back, Reverend Mariama.
Good to be here.
And Shagun Itawu. He's the executive director at the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts and co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. Shagun, welcome.
I appreciate you having me today.
So if you don't mind, the two of you, I'd love to start by taking a call. Our lines have been full since before the break, and giving you a chance to engage directly with our listeners. I'd like to take a call from Brad in Belmont. Brad, go ahead.
Hi. Hello?
You okay, Brad?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. I'm well, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm afraid what I have to say doesn't really have much to do with your guest right now. My former comment had to do with the last segment. I apologize.
No, that's okay, Brad. You go ahead and make your point. Our guests are well-versed.
I'm actually losing my battery. I'll call you back. Thank you.
Okay, so we had a little bit of a misfire with Brad there, so let me turn to the two of you, and I'm sorry to make you wait. I wanted to kind of begin to immediately engage. Reverend Mariama, let me start with you. We've talked to you a couple of times in the last couple of weeks. You delighted me with a call during our week in review, talking about the plans of your congregation and how you're balancing your congregation, your community, and now we add the events of the last week. How are you, and how are you thinking about it?
So my computer is acting up. So go ahead and talk to Shagun, and I'm going to try to figure out why it's doing this.
Okay. And we will all take a moment to say that the technological gods clearly are challenging us in this conversation between Brad's phone and Reverend Mariama's computer. Shagun, you've been very patient. Let me begin by checking in with you. How are you? What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, I don't think I've fully processed everything that's been happening. I think a lot of people in my community feel the same way. A lot of us feel, can't believe we have to do this again. Not only that, but in the middle of a global pandemic. And so folks are not only risking their lives already because of the pandemic, which is hurting our community way more than others, but now have to protest systemic racism and police violence, and are risking ourselves in that way. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about something my grandfather told me back in 2012. He told me not to confuse motion with progress, because if I were to have moved his rocking chair, it would move but not make any progress. And so I've been thinking a lot about that and how we're here because we have been we've been okay with just making movement when it comes to solving a lot of these issues. I haven't made a lot of progress. So that's where I'm at this point.
Reverend Mariama, are you back with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I think that there are some ways in which I agree with Shagun. I think that there's a long way to go. I do think there are some promising signs in the sense that in the past, police officers were not even fired. no one was charged. So while I think that what is happening now is clearly inadequate, it shouldn't have taken national movement for Ahmaud Arbery's killers to be brought to justice. I do recognize that 5 years ago, they weren't even being brought to justice. They weren't even being arrested. That being said, this is really overwhelming. As a pastor, I mean, I think over this last week or so, I've had lots of calls, lots of moments with my parishioners who actually, we are a really multiracial community. We are 40% Black, but 35% white, 10% Latino, 10% Asian. Like, I've seen a level of anguish, I think, because everybody is wondering, what will it take for this to actually shift? You know, folks are trying to figure out, some of my members who are very active, but who have compromised immune systems and can't, I've been saying to them, I love you, but I can't condone you going out. I don't want you to get sick. And so there really are so many compounding issues. It feels like the world is falling apart. But part of what I've had to remind folks is, to some extent, for many of us, the world wasn't working before. And the big question becomes, I think, you know, as Segun mentioned, how do we not just move things around? How do we move them forward? And I think that is the question we really need to be wrestling with in this moment.
I'd like to add a caller voice here. Hopefully this time it's going to work out. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Jeannie on the line from the South Shore. Jeannie, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I will do my best to articulate what I can, despite my nerves. But a couple of things. I guess the number one of the things that just I keep envisioning is the coverage of white men in protests a week or so ago, protesting the restrictions on businesses and social things happening. And so people were protesting that. And I remember seeing people, these men, armed with guns that started at their shoulders and went down to like their waist, strapped with these guns. And it was shocking then. And now, you know, compared to what is now being said and compared to the people who are trying to protest peacefully. And I know it's not shocking to any of you, especially, you know, your guests.
But Jeannie, let us take it from there and get our guest's response to that. Jeannie, I'm sorry, I'm going to take it back from you. You've made a point there that I want to make sure I get a response from our guests on, because it's something that has come up. I'm glad you brought it up. It's come up repeatedly in the last couple of weeks, that the rhetoric in response to armed protesters inside and outside of government buildings in response to government shutdowns for the pandemic versus public response to protests in the streets, unarmed protests in the streets around the death of George Floyd. Segun, let me invite you to sort of first take the first reaction to that.
Well, you know, I'll thank Jeannie for raising that point. I mean, she's absolutely correct of the difference in reporting as well as the attitudes toward the folks who were doing that. You know, I won't even take it to folks who were armed across the country that were going to their state legislatures or other buildings to protest or demand that their state reopen. I'll just think of even here in Massachusetts, the folks who showed up to the governor's house and were protesting, the rhetoric and the sentiments of folks in response to that was that, well, clearly the governor needs to make this decision to reopen the state because people are frustrated and this proves it. And yet I remember very clearly back in 2014, 15, when organizers protested at the mayor's house here in Boston and the homes of other politicians. It was used against the organizers and against the protesters to say, how dare they show up to the homes of these politicians to make these demands. There are other ways to do this. And so, I mean, it just continues to prove the fact that when white people do it, it's okay and it's justifiable. I think even of the riots that happen after games, when the team wins or loses, but they are never, ever tied to an entire community or folks are not looked at in a negative manner. It's used to justify their concerns. But when Black people do it, there is always that voice saying, you got to find another way. And so, you know, she's right to raise that point, and it's evident again here in this situation.
Reverend Mariam, I listen to Segun, I listen to Jeannie's call, and I think about a listener out there who is saying, at the same time, there have been people who have participated, have been on the streets during these protests around the country, who have committed acts of violence, who have committed looting, who have thrown bricks through glass, et cetera. What is the right contextual response to those behaviors and those choices in this moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are two pieces I would look at. So first of all, this kind of violence people do find shocking, but there are many kinds of violence that are dangerous and kill people that we never see. There are times when we make decisions about policies that mean life or death for people, and you don't get held accountable in the same way when you make decisions that will kill people in that way than when you see someone throwing a rock. So I just want us to remind ourselves that there's lots of ways to create harm, and some of the ones that seem relatively benign in some people's eyes are policy decisions, the decisions around hiring and firing when companies lay off, you know, thousands of workers when sometimes they don't need to. All of these can be real forms of violence that hurt people. But I think the second is, and I think when you see people angry because they've experienced that kind of violence, that's real. And so I just want to name that. I'm not saying I condone it. I have never thrown a rock through something. I'm just wanting to name that people's frustration also comes out of the violence that they feel perpetrated against them. I think the second piece is, as someone who's been in those spaces, I want to question how much of the starting of these things is by young people in some of the most vulnerable and affected neighborhoods. I have been a marshal in some of these spaces. I've been on security teams. I know people who were on the security teams for what happened on Sunday. And what many of them said is that the folks who were most looking to rile people up were not young people of color from Roxbury experiencing police brutality, but white young people from other communities who we don't even know. So I think I just want people to be able to separate out the real demands that people are raising about the violence that they experience in their communities, and those folks who are committing these acts, which a lot of times are not even the same people.
I'm about to go to a call. I do want to note in reference to what you just said, Reverend Mariama, that yesterday during the press conference, Boston Police Department Commissioner William Gross did note that about half of the arrests that came out of Sunday night were people who were from outside the city. That, of course, means the other half were people who were from inside the city, but about half were from outside. Let's take another call here, 1-800-423-8255. We have Jamil on the line from Dorchester. Go ahead.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Okay, great. Now, me, myself, I don't condone the looting and the violence and things of that nature, but a lot of things are very deep-rooted that people should at least try to think about. Now, some people say that, hey, you know, slavery had happened a long time ago, you know, like, you know, it ended 100 years ago. But I think a lot of African-Americans, well, it's not just African-Americans looting. It's also some Caucasians and some Spanish. But I think a lot of African-Americans, a lot of them are still suffering from the ghost of plantation life. What you have to think about, what happened to us during slavery is still affecting some of us. You have to think of it this way. Have a crystal vase. Sometimes people say vase. But let's imagine you have a crystal vase. A big, giant, beautiful one. You go on top of the potential Prudential building and you throw that vase down on the ground. That vase will shatter into a million, probably a trillion pieces. That is what happened to the soul, the social, economic, the moral, the human nature, the essence. That's what happened to African Americans during slavery. Slavery has done
a
job.
So, Jamil,
Yes.
I don't mean to I do mean to interrupt you. I apologize for interrupting you, but again, I want to pick up the point that you've made there. I want to stick with that mental image of the crystal vase, and I want to take or vase. I grew up saying vase, and I want to bring it back to our panelists to give us a chance to respond to that thought and that imagery about the history of systemic racism and racial oppression in the United States. Shagun, let me invite you to respond to what Jamil's saying and to add your own thoughts to that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jamil is right to bring that up. And that's exactly what we're talking about when we're in the streets. And you know, I just want to say, too, that I always appreciate being anywhere where Reverend Mariama is, you know, and her bringing her perspectives to this conversation. She's absolutely right, even as she talks about Sunday and who was stirring up a lot of the violence in the beginning. But, you know, Jamil is right about the fact that all of this has to do with the original sin of this country, which was the enslavement of African peoples. And the country has never, ever dealt explicitly with that issue. I mean, we can talk about the Civil War, but even after the Civil War, the country refused to deal with how to resolve and atone for its sin. You know, BECMA, the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts, put out a statement earlier this week where, you know, we acknowledge the fact that systemic racism is the disease that America has given up finding the vaccine for. And so the folks that you see in the streets today and the people who were doing the work every day in between those protests. And I think it's important to talk about the fact that, you know, these protests, you know, they highlight and amplify the points that are being that folks are raising. But people are talking about this and pushing back every single day. Reverend Mariama, Monica Cannon, Councillor Janey, and many, many others who are working on this every day to push our elected and appointed officials, to push folks in the business community to address this. But again, he's right. Systemic racism is the root cause for all of this. And, you know, there's a James Baldwin quote that's been floating around where he talks about the fact that, you know, it's taken my mother's time and my father's time, my sister's and my brother's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress? We've been waiting for so long for this issue to be addressed. And it's not until we address the root of this problem that we'll stop seeing these protests and this rebellion and these uprisings that we're seeing happening across the country.
So, Reverend Mariama, in our last minute, understanding the size and the scope of what we face if we're going to start to take steps forward to heal, what is one public policy step that could happen next, that could happen now, that would put us on that path?
So I do want to both say there's no one thing we can do that's going to solve this, because it took us more than 400 years to get here, and we got a lot of work to do. That being said, there are some pretty clear evidence-based pieces about what we could do to reduce police brutality. And one of them is changing our policies to make sure that these practices are not allowed. And then when people violate the policies, I believe in unions, I believe in labor organizing, but sometimes our police contracts allow folks who have done these things again and again to have their records expunged or hidden from the community, which only makes them more likely to continue escalating this type of behavior. So I think we've got a lot to do in every part of our society, but I do think there are some basic evidence-based reforms that we can start with that address the specifics of this situation, even as we need to continue going deeper to face the ugly history that we have never fully addressed.
That's Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and an activist and organizer. Thank you for joining us today. And Shigun Itowu, the executive director at the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts and co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. Thanks to you, too.